Welcome to the Nerd Journey Podcast. Our goal is to help you, the technology professional, accelerate your career progression, increase your job satisfaction, and be more effective in your existing role.
We want to bring listeners like you the career advice we wish we'd been given earlier in our careers.
I'm John White at VJourneyman on Twitter, sharing co-host duties with Nick Cordy at NetworkNerd _.
We're two former IT operations guys who have moved on to pre-sales roles with technology vendors. We have our opinions, but we also like to highlight the journeys of others and see what we can learn from them.
We'd also like to ask for your feedback to make this a conversation, not a one-way broadcast. Email us at nerdjourneypodcast@gmail.com or DM us at nerdjourney on Twitter. So come join us on our nerd journey.
Let's take a trip. The time for episode 268 is right now. This week, we're going to share part two of a discussion with our guest, Eric Gross. He's a technologist, an entrepreneur, a career coach, and the co-founder of the Tech Academy. If you missed part one of our discussion with Eric in episode 267, we talked about this theme of learning in different environments over the course of Eric's life, learning from his father as a young boy, learning during his naval service as a student and as a teacher, and then additional learning as a traveling salesman selling sunglasses. When we finished up that episode, we were talking about Eric's decision to make a job change and what caused him to take action after recognizing it wasn't ideal for his family. This week in part two, you're going to see an overarching theme of ownership and resilience through difficult decisions. We'll talk about this from the perspective of the entrepreneur. When should the entrepreneur make a change in whether they keep moving forward or perhaps abandon a goal? How do you know? And what's the impact? Another difficult decision is laying people off. That's something entrepreneurs and business owners may have to do so their company survives. We'll talk through the layoff situation from the perspective of three personas: the business owner who makes the decision to do it, the manager who has to execute, and the person who's impacted by the layoff or job loss, as we might call it. Then we'll talk through Eric's pivot into becoming a technologist and getting paid as a software developer. This is actually another story about taking ownership of his current state and the mismatch between that and what his capabilities were. I'll let you hear the rest of the story as we get to part two of our discussion with Eric Gross.
I finally decided you got to do it. You got to do it. You have to pull that Band-Aid off and just make the change and trust that you've got enough mental toughness to transition to something.
And is the advice the same for the technology entrepreneur? Because I'm really curious about that. I remember hearing a former guest, Al Elliott, saying that the entrepreneur likes to solve problems, but they pretty much know that their idea of what the problem solution might look like may not necessarily be what it actually is in the end state to best solve the problem.
Yeah, you're 1,000% right. Like my advice would definitely jive with that kind of a viewpoint. The fact is that I've had successes entrepreneurially and I've had failures. In every instance, the form that it was in when it either fell apart or when it really popped was greatly different than what I initially envisioned. This is this thing I learned, you know, bit by piece over the years, which is that moments when you find out that you're wrong about something are golden. They're some of the most important moments you can ever have in your life. You find out a few really important things about yourself in that moment. One, do you have enough self-respect to be willing to acknowledge that you're wrong about something? And two, you start to recognize the opportunity you have, which is that having been able to stare in the face the fact that you're wrong about something, and sometimes it can be something very important or vital to you, having identified the thing that you were wrong about, this affected your performance or behavior in life to a great degree for years, you're left with this wide open vista in front of you in your future that now every single time that thing you were wrong about comes into play, you're never going to do it wrong again. That's something that took years for me to have a little bit of maturity about. But that is generally how I respond after I get over some of the emotion of it when I find out I'm wrong about something. And it's something we coach people on all the time in my entrepreneurial work, And, you know, when we work with get technologists breaking into tech, there ain't nobody who's right all the time. That's ludicrous. But how you respond when you finally go, oh, wow, yeah, I was wrong about that. Those are growing moments.
I feel there are two elements to the getting past it and being more resilient. The getting past your ego, putting that aside, like, this is a poor reflection on me because I got it wrong, and feeling bad about your own self-worth because you got it wrong. And then the, where do I get the wherewithal to try harder or try that same thing again or adjust it? Why not just quit? That's more than two things, but...
No, you're spot on. Yeah, I've seen, at least from my point of view, which is just, it's just one guy's point of view, right? That there's two factors at play here. And the first one is that what you say to yourself sticks. When you say positive self-validating things about you, they have a tendency to stick. But when you say negative things about yourself, maybe you never voice them out loud, but they're inside there, those unfortunately stick really, really well. I found it really helpful to recognize that most of those things, they come from outside influences. They come from others' criticism, others' attempt to belittle you or cause invalidation or cause uncertainty or worry in your life. And you can grab onto them and hold them, and they start to feel like that's actually you. But they originally came from outside of you. When you're a kid, man, the world's your oyster and life is full of brightness and gold and goodness and joy. External influences can beat that out of you, but it never truly goes away. And the other part of it is that no one else can stand up when they get knocked down besides you yourself. Yes, other people can help lift you up, but at the end of the day, even if they're lifting, you have to choose to stand. There's aspects of my life of a personal nature of tremendous loss and pain that probably aren't the right forum for here. But while I didn't always get it right, I got it right more often than not, long enough that I started to recognize something about myself. And I've found that it's true, honestly, for anyone, which is that your toughness is more than you give yourself permission to believe. We are incredibly resilient. And that choice of whether to stand up when you get knocked down, whether it's a minor knockdown or a flat-out KO, you do have that choice. And the more you exercise it, the more you start to recognize your own innate toughness. It doesn't mean being tough in the uncaring sense at all. It means just a recognition of the fact that you have tremendous power, that you're inevitably going to fail in certain areas, but that the joy is you can always stand up and you can always make tomorrow a brand new day. I know it sounds like a platitude, but it's true for me, and I've seen it be true for a lot of other people.
Yeah, I like that. That leads me to this question. How does one make a determination between the things you just said? I have, you know, we have tremendous power to be resilient and keep going, get back on the horse, so to speak. Where is the decision point between I should keep going, get back up on the horse versus now this is really just kind of an irresponsible, blind optimism?
Yeah, I love this question. And you know what I really appreciate about this is that this is a question that anyone has encountered in their life, this dilemma, but particularly people who are entrepreneurially minded. When do you pull that plug? When am I being foolish, Pollyanna-ish about, wow, it's actually not going to happen? And that ego thing you talked about can get in the way. Look, these things I'm spouting out, I'm not perfect at these by any way, any stretch of the imagination. But sometimes I am, and I've found them valuable myself and others. So I'll just tell you how I feel about it. And it's this, that ultimately all you can do is attempt to be as objective as possible in the moment and look at a situation and analyze the two decisions you have in front of you. Continue to plow down this road that so far has been kicking my behind, or let go of it, abandon that purpose, that goal, and pivot. When you look at that, you've got several different areas of your life that can be affected either way. Personal, family, groups or work, and frankly, might have an impact on all people to some extent. Only you can tell and judge what's going to do the greatest good over the longest period of time. It's a very personal decision. But if you've got at least that sort of a mental framework to step back and go, okay, let me try to strip the emotion out of this. I've got these two options. When I'm being truthful to myself, which one of these over the long term is going to produce the greatest good for myself, my family, the groups I'm involved with? And when you find that choice and you stare at it, it may not be the one you wanted, but you got to own it. No one else can make the decision for you. And then you go, okay, yeah, I'm going to make the shift. And you can't look back. You can't get stuck in the regret of it. It'll just kill you if you do. So again, I'm not perfect at that at all, but I have had to do it. I'll tell you, we're jumping ahead to the creation of the Tech Academy, but the first moment when my co-founder and I, as we were growing, scaling upward, when we first had to do a large layoff, not a layoff for cause or whatever, but like we had a bump and we had to lay off a good chunk of people. That's a rough, rough decision. These people that joined you in your mission, leaned into it like you are, that you are like in the trenches, and you have to tell like a third of them that you didn't make it go right to build the business strong enough to be able to afford them, and you have to let them go. That is rough, but you've got to analyze it objectively and you pull the Band-Aid off, but you can't look back in regret on it. Otherwise, it was for naught, and you'll still dwindle afterwards because you're stuck in the loss of what you had to do.
That has to be incredibly hard. Not only realizing that you need to downsize your employee base, but deciding by how much, and then furthermore, once you decide by how much, semi-objectively, who's it going to be? And everybody wants to know, Eric, why me?
Yep.
You know, especially in the tech industry over the last couple of years, as the time we're recording this, layoffs are a thing. So let's play both sides of the coin while we're on the topic. I'm a manager, and I've just been told that I have to lay people off. I don't have a choice in the matter. What's your advice for the manager in that situation? And then let's go to the side of the employee that gets hit.
For the manager, I always think that the first person that they need to handle or get clarity and resolution with is internally, it's within themselves. If they embark on this task of actually putting into execution the layoffs and the exit interviews and all that kind of stuff without assessing their own internal disagreement or upset with it, it's going to go very, very poorly. In other words, if there's still any part of you that is like, man, why? Why are we doing this? Any frustration on it, you've got to have your own conversation with your leader and fully resolve that before you just jump into, Pete, come meet with me in my office. Jane, come meet with my office, right? As you're embarking on it. Or you'll be doing it insincerely. You'll be doing it with your own doubts and reservations about the action. So handle yourself first is my recommendation. And the second thing is in terms of like, how do you even decide who? There's a lot of discussion we can have around developer metrics and contribution and all that sort of thing. But regardless of which way you lay it out, you as an engineer should have enough knowledge of the needs of the business, the book of business of projects that you're actually running, what the future looks like over 6, 12, 18, 36 months in your area to recognize, okay, in this group, who's going to produce the greatest amount of positive forward motion over that period? You have to rank them. You have to. And it sucks. No one wants to be judged and no one wants to judge others. It's, well, okay, there's some sociopaths out there that love that kind of stuff. I don't know about you. I don't like it at all.
Yeah, I don't like it. Don't like it at all.
Ultimately, that is part of your responsibility. You have certain rights as a manager, but you have a responsibility. And that balancing of ultimately the company has to survive, and that's your responsibility. You can't get away from that. That's why you took the job. You didn't take it to be popular. That said, be gracious and kind in what you're doing. But once you've ranked them with that kind of a metric in mind, it'll be clear. Now, as to how to handle those conversations, man, we're going right back to what you said so well earlier, like that understanding the viewpoint that the other person has. Like, what's that like? I've been fired. It stinks to high heaven. Thank you very much. I have had a few occasions where the person who had to do it was so gracious, so kind about it, that of course it stung, but I let go of it very quickly and was able to move on. And how about some where there was invalidation and crass or rude, like it just was not handled with kindness. Again, I know it's really trite and I might come across as a bit naive or whatever about life, but I got 54, almost 55 years of it under my belt and I've learned a few things. I still have a lot more. You can never go wrong with being kind and nice to other people.
In any situation.
Yeah. Now to flip it over to the you as a how to receive it. I was just delivering a talk to our current students and people who've graduated recently from the school just last night. And something like this just came up. So I kind of know how I feel about it. This was in the relationship to the interview process and getting the job, but it applies here. You have to prepare to be rejected in the interview process. We all know you're going to get a heck of a lot more no's than you're going to get yeses. It's just, it's the truth of the matter. You have to prepare to be rejected. And the fact is that even in the most ideal work situation, there is always a possibility that something will happen and they're going to have to let you go. If you've endeavored to do a good job and wear your hat really well on that, and you're able to look at that and leave with your head held high, that can help. But I've got no advice that would be worth anything if it was just simply as trite as, well, just get over it or try not to be bothered or whatever. It stinks. No two ways about it. The only thing I can say is that I feel very affectionate and caring towards the technology industry for a couple of very specific reasons. Knowledge workers are incredibly valuable. We're capable of taking very real human needs, very real human problems, and applying these soulless tools of digital computers to those human problems and producing an effect of good far in excess of the amount of time we spend on it. And it takes a special type of mind and hardworking person and stick-to-itiveness, toughness, willingness to be wrong over and over again and then finally get the code right, that kind of a person to solve these things. So I'm saying all that to say that when you do get let go, don't ever lose sight of how valuable you are. Yes, get knocked down. Feel bad for a day or so. Go take a walk. Like, yes, it's going to stink. But don't for a moment think that that isn't you that's invalid, that you somehow are lesser than. And that's the advice I give for it. And again, I know that's not the easiest thing in the world to do. And I've done it wrong often enough. I've been let go and just like went into a funk. Luckily, I have a great wife and she's like, you're not going to stay in that funk. That's not okay. Go get a job. Right? Which is another lesson. Surround yourself with really awesome people who see what you really are and demand that you live up to it.
Ah, there you go.
This is my second marriage. And man, did I get a winner. And she's, you know, is very understanding of the fact that I'm a big old fat nerd and I tell stupid jokes and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, she's under no illusions about what my strengths are and my weaknesses are. And she knows how tough and capable I actually am. And if I ever descend into thinking it's not true and not living up to what I'm actually capable of, she'll say so kindly, but she will not let that stand. Be that friend for someone and surround yourself with friends like that is my advice.
Yeah, I hope everyone has a friend like that. I would put my wife in the same category. She's always believed. Sometimes I wonder why, but she always has, you know? Let's play one other angle while we're here, and that's the business owner who comes to that realization. What's it like for that person who has to come to terms with, okay, we have to do this? I may not be the one who's executing it at the lowest levels.
Yeah, but someone's executing it for you, yeah.
Right, but I have to start the chain of events in that direction.
This is rough, man. These are important questions you're asking, but they are rough. Here's the thing is, when you decide to start an activity, when you decide to start a group, whether you're stating it out loud or internally, or you're not even looking at it, the fact is that you've made a contract with yourself and with anyone else who chooses you and chooses to join you on that mission. And that contract includes, for me at least, one overriding principle. You as the creator of that activity are 100% responsible for its success or failure. Period. End of story. And when you ask people to join you, you can ask them to be equally as responsible as you are for the survival of that activity. And when you find the right people, they'll lean in and they'll be like that. I have countless examples of the Tech Academy. We have phenomenal people there. But at the end of the day, you own that thing, good or bad, and how well it went. So let's get to some concrete. This is just advice that's worth what you're paying for it. I got it. You're the business owner and you're in that position and you have to make that call. The last thing you want to do is imply in any way, shape, or form that the decision was anybody else's but yours. Because it's not true. If you abdicated to someone else, you've already abdicated your own ownership and responsibility for the success of that activity, and you got much bigger problems. But at the end of the day, if it's your gig, whether you wrote it down on paper or in an email or not, you're not going to do those layoffs without you being okay with it. Don't ever back off of that and pretend that in any way, shape, or form it was someone else. And secondly, without putting yourself in any kind of legal hot water, because I understand there's publicly owned companies and stockholders and, you know, the legal folks have to look at this stuff. It is important. You've got to take responsibility for it. It's your actions or lack thereof, your push to produce execution in the people underneath you that joined you in this endeavor
that led to that point. And even if it seems to be an outside force, the macroeconomics, I hear this phrase a lot, macroeconomic climate, you're still responsible for not getting your company in such a strong economic position that it could weather that. And whether you like that communication or not, it's the truth. You weren't set up well enough to accommodate that. Now, all that said, sometimes you got to do it and you bite the bullet and you get it done and you move on and the company survives. And I know that sounds brutal and there's often sometimes in this society, a worker-oriented sort of culture, but the fact is they wouldn't even have an opportunity to be a worker if someone wasn't brave enough to say, hey, I'm going to start this thing and I'm 100% responsible for succeeding. Without that action occurring, you don't even have a job. So I don't like a management worker divide at all, but having done a lot of entrepreneurial work, it's the truth. You put yourself out there to build this thing. You're owning it fully. That means you're responsible and have the right to cut off parts of it if it isn't working. I didn't realize I had so much to say about that. Thanks for that question.
Yeah, that was a great answer. So if you're an entrepreneur listening, you have a lot to think about, or the would-be business owner, or even the would-be manager, or the would-be employee, really.
Yeah. In a manager's department, it's a microcosm of what's going on with that overall concept. It's absolutely true.
What made you want to gain experience managing people at all? Because, you know, you eventually became sort of business partner, company founder multiple times. But I'm just curious, people have different motivations for going into people management. I'd love to hear yours.
Part of it is that impulse to teach well. And look, full disclosure, I've got a mixed rate of success as a people manager. Great as an entrepreneur, that person starting the thing and building it and everything, right? In terms of establishing the activity and putting in all these policies and making things grow in a scalable manner, I do decently. I also know where my strengths lie and where they don't. And so I choose business partners to work with that complement me well. So like at the Tech Academy, my business partner, Jack, is unbelievably good in this area, extremely. And I've gotten better and better at it over the years. But ultimately, to answer your question, as I've had an opportunity, like, you know, opportunities like that in my life, like when I would run people in sunglass sales or when I, you know, was a store manager and when I was selling flooring, right? At the end of the day, what drew me to that is that I get tremendous personal joy from watching someone become more of who they are. I can see a possibility there. I can see this tremendous ability that can be unleashed, whether it's as a salesperson or as an engineer or as a project manager or as someone who can achieve consensus in a real divided group, right? I can see this ability there. And when someone doesn't believe that about themselves, but I know it's true from close interaction with them, it is tremendously gratifying to help them push through that and start to recognize how awesome they really are. And when you do that, as long as you operate within the confines of how that the policies and procedures of that company work, then you're a good manager of people. Yes, you have to pay attention to policies and procedures. But ultimately, it's those people and their personal belief and confidence in themselves that's going to produce that forward motion in what you're all trying to get done as a group.
This is sort of a form. I wouldn't call it exactly the same, but a form of being that friend that helps pick people up that you spoke about earlier. It's not exactly the same relationship, but seeing those capabilities of what could be in the people that come and work under you.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, wanting to grow those and unleash them.
Yeah, the business dynamic is such that there's only certain aspects of working with someone that you can really delve into for it to make sense. But even in that realm, look, I have this odd mix of things I do right now. I'm the co-founder of a school and I'm involved in, you know, like different curriculum development and marketing for it. I also work full-time for a phenomenal technology training company. And I've got my activity of career coaching and entrepreneurial coaching for technologists. So I've got these three different sectors in my life. In the regular full-time employment, I have an amazing manager. I have an amazing manager, equally able to balance the needs of the business versus the long-term success career-wise of the people under her. So thankful that I have that. And she makes a real big difference in my life. So yeah, you have that opportunity as a people leader to do that. And yes, you're going to help accomplish the goals of the business. You should, but you have an opportunity along the way to genuinely help people grow personally and professionally. And when you do that, man, undying loyalty. Like, I'll do anything for my boss. She's amazing.
I hope everybody has a boss like that at some point in their career, hopefully for most of your career.
I've had the others. I'm really glad to have this kind.
One thing we didn't discuss, Eric, was how you eventually landed or started working with a technology focus? Because I think it was software development, right?
Yeah.
So how did that happen?
It's really wild. Like, a lot of my public persona right now is completely known as a technologist, cloud transformation consultant, technology entrepreneur, founder of a coding school. The fact is that in terms of professionally being paid directly as a developer, that didn't start till 2011. But I've been doing coding and technology since I was 11 years old. So brief highlights on that journey, like how did I even get here, are that I did a lot of coding as a teenager. I was coding before I had a computer, coding on one of those really complex Texas Instruments calculators, putting games in there you could play with just that little output of nine-digit numbers. That's it, right?
TI-83, something like that?
Yes, TI-84.
Okay, yeah.
Love that machine. And did a lot of programming, right? For both school exercises and, it's going to be a big shock, I'm a Dungeons & Dragons nerd, building programs to help me run, you know, games and develop characters, all this nerdy stuff. But then I went in the Navy, and while I wasn't programming in the Navy, what happened there was really cool. They were trying to equip us to go out into a fleet where we didn't know whether the boat we were going to get sent to was brand new, just deployed 6 months ago, or 40 years old, because the fleet's got a lot of technology. So they had to prep us for everything, which meant a very deep dive into digital circuitry, every component that makes up CPUs, computer memory, how digital storage works. All of it was very, very, very deep, down to the silicon and germanium used in transistors and how you build logic gates and how you take those to create adders, stuff that can actually do, you know, addition and subtraction with binary, and how you build an instruction set on a chip. And like, all of it was very deep in that program. So again, I'm not working in it yet. I went to a ship that was commissioned in 1956, did not have any computer stuff on it, but I'm still surrounded by that stuff. Then I get out and I'm in sales and I'm like, oh, I moved away from that. Huh. And then 1996 comes, the web and e-commerce are starting to actually heat up. And my bosses, at this point, partners, said, you know, Eric, we've been hearing about this web thing and apparently people are like buying stuff on it. We need a website. Okay. So I happened to be in the Midwest somewhere. I think I was in Missouri, and went to a huge mall that I saw nearby because it was a giant white tent in the mall. I'm like, something about that's cool. I go in, and this was done for a long time. I don't think that people are doing it now, but people would rent space in a giant mall parking lot, set up a huge tent, and pull in 10 or 20 or 30,000 books that were they hadn't sold in the retail stores. And so I went in and I bought 8 or 10 technology books for about $3 each. And learned HTML, CSS, JavaScript, Visual Basic, and built their first e-commerce site. Oh man, I love this stuff. But then I was off selling, you know, sunglasses. You flash forward in the early 2000s, I'm working for a flooring company. And there I am, I'm being a salesman. But we have this very complex software that manages, look, this, all the jobs, everything from inventory to control to selling the jobs, installing them, billing, everything, right? Very complex software. And this was a huge company. They were the 20th biggest flooring company in the country at the time, right? And so their software needs were tremendous. And they decided to upgrade to the newest version of that software. And it was a nightmare. And I saw it being a nightmare and went, oh, I know about technology. Boom, I got slurped up into that and helped with all of the implementation and setting up all the customization. And I'm like, I really do love this. But I'm in sales. I'm in sales. And you flash forward, and at each sort of job or chapter in my life, technology would come creeping in. But the actual shift happened at a very low point in my life. 2008, 9, 10 was not doing well financially, was not doing well at home because we're not well off financially. Like, it causes a lot of stress. I know our listeners can commiserate with that, right? And it finally came to a point where a good friend sat me down in a closed room. And I know this is clean podcast, so I'll clean it up. He said very clearly, and this is a person that it's only a handful of people in my life could talk to me this way. And I knew where their heart was. He said, Eric, it is not okay that you're not making a lot of money. It is not okay. He said it a little more strongly than that and with a little more creative language. But he was right. I was letting myself down and a lot of people down around me. So for the next few days, I was in a like reeling, like it didn't leave me. Something has to change. So I'm on a drive with my friend Jack, who, look, the Tech Academy was not even a thing at this point, but ended up being my co-founder in the Tech Academy. And we're on a drive, and I'm talking through this with him. And so he's like, okay, well, tell me about your background. I'm like, do you know things that can make a lot of money? And I started talking about technology and computers. And the more I t- talking through this, he's looking at me weird. He's like, wait a minute, you've been programming since you were 11. You did all this computer nerdy stuff in the Navy. Why aren't you doing this? I don't know. Maybe I'm an idiot. So long story short, he says, I got to get you on the phone with a friend of mine who's in tech. Because maybe you could go back to school, go to college and learn some stuff, whatever. I get on the phone with this guy who ended up becoming a really good friend. And I talked to him for 30, 45 minutes. And he starts really quizzing me about what I know. Because I'm like, what do I do? Like, should I go get a degree in this? Or like, at the end of it, he said, Eric, you don't need to go do a degree. You just need to learn how is software being made now. What are the current technologies? That's all. He says, I can give you the kind of things you're going to need to learn. I can write it down for you. And if you're willing to burn the midnight oil and just rip through this and get up to speed on how software is being made right now, I can try to get you in on a contract I have with the state. Now, you're going to have to travel 60 miles every day to go do this contract, and you've got to get up to speed, and it's going to be really rough. But if you'll do that, I'll go to bat for you. I'm like, whoa. So I go home and I sit down and talk to my wife, Cherie, and say, look, here's this opportunity. My friend, and I explain the whole thing. I'm like, it might be months of me burning the midnight oil to try to get up to speed on technology. This could turn out to be something really cool. He's telling me about the wages that people in tech make, and I do love computers, but I've got to have your agreement that I'm going to be heads down on this for a long time to try to break into this. And she looked at it and said, yeah, let's do this. So I bought a cheap old computer off of Craigslist. I went to Goodwill and bought like 30 tech books for like $8 because Goodwill's got cheap things. And I started staying up to 1 or 2 or 3 in the morning, day after day after day after day, like learning the fundamentals, reinforcing HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, which, you know, changed a little bit, right? And going back into what are the modern programming languages? He said, I need to know about C#. Okay, what does that look like? And like, what's this object-oriented thing? And like, oh, databases. Well, I did a lot of this in high school, but it's been a long time. And I just dove in. And I'm like, okay, this is my life for the next 3 or 4 or 5 months. So 2.5 weeks into this, that moment happens. Like it happened on the submarine. And it all clicks. And I went, oh. And I wrote up a resume and sent it out. And 1 week later, I had a job for $84,000 a year. I'd been making $38,000 a year or less. My life changed on a dime. It was that come to Jesus moment of a friend sitting down and saying, this is not okay. And suddenly I looked inside and I found out the tools I needed, I already had. They'd been sitting there with me the whole time. And that's when it became a professional activity, and it's exploded since then. And I love the industry and have done very, very well in it. But that's how it started. Not everybody knows all that.
So I want to highlight some things from what you just shared. I love the fact that you decided you needed to do something based on a close friend's feedback. I realize this person's right, not just intellectually, but emotionally, psychologically. That is going to spur me to do something. And then once that person knew that you were really going to do something, they put the bridge across the moat for you and said, here, talk to this person. And then that person gave you a recipe, which was another one of those offerings of, if you'll do these things, and again, you were motivated enough to do the things. So I think what we can learn from that is it's never a bad idea to tell someone the things you know, even if it's only a little bit, right? I only know this much, or here's where I am, and ask me some questions to validate that, and then getting some guidance from someone who does that thing or is in that industry today on how could you build yourself up to get to the point where you could do that full time. I really like that.
Yeah, that's spot on.
And for you, you found the thing that you could monetize.
Yeah.
And that is actually something that you help people do now. So this is a perfect transition point to talk about that. One of the quotes that hit me the hardest from that particular part of the interview was about being that friend. Can we, and are we willing to, be that friend for someone else that recognizes the potential in the other person, but at the same time expects them to live up to that potential? It's not in a mean way, but in a kind, honest way, holding someone accountable and really making that person own it, own the action, own the decision to do something about it. Eric gives the example of his wife and some friends who did this exact thing for him. In some situations, the holding Eric accountable was a little bit more firm than others, but it was still out of a caring for Eric that these people did that. We didn't call it this in the interview, but this is really mentorship. A mentor is someone who can hold you accountable in a kind way, making you own your actions, not letting you off the hook, not letting you make excuses. A coach can do that as well, but I immediately thought of a mentor when doing that. And you may be in a mentor or mentee relationship with someone without having officially classified it in that way. So I hope that each of us can be that friend for someone else, and hopefully you have that person in your life who can be that friend for you. I liked the discussions of decisions, difficult decisions, but also the analysis of the impact of those decisions. So this is especially important for the entrepreneur, of course, because it could mean that they're abandoning a goal or even shutting down a business. That has a pretty big impact to a lot of people, or could potentially have the impact to a lot of people. It's also important to people with families. We've had many guests who've been on the show, and a consistent pattern when they are looking at job changes or general big life changes, these former guests found it important to go get input on the decision from their families because they knew that making this choice impacted more than just them. It's very similar to the moment in our discussion when Eric talks about getting the recipe for what he needed to do to get into tech, to make it as a software developer. He took that to his wife, told her what it would take, and he was asking for her support because he knew the impact would be a lot of his time spent doing it. And she was on board. She was there to support him. My take is if he had not done that, and if some of our previous guests had not done that before they made some of these big decisions, the road would have been a lot bumpier and it might have turned out way different. So we need the support of others in our family when we're going after trying to make a change in our lives. We might need the okay to put in more time in a specific area. There's also this theme of kindness. We talk about holding people accountable in a kind way. It really does matter. Kindness matters in the way we do things, the approach we take, the attitude we have. It really reminds me of former guest Al Rashid. He's someone who has said kindness matters a number of times. Shout out to you, Al. Thanks for sharing that positive message with the community. And this kindness matters in the way difficult things like layoffs are executed. It matters in the way we treat other people who've been impacted by these tough situations. And it also matters in how we treat ourselves. There was a discussion of self-talk in there. Do you have negative self-talk? Are you beating yourself up about things you should have done, could have done, wanted to do differently? Can we be kind to ourselves and forgive ourselves for making mistakes, for failing at things we didn't want to fail at, so that we won't regret them? And so that we can move on and move forward and stop spending time, effort in the regret and negative self-talk and more time and effort toward the thing we want to achieve, getting better at something, advancing in our career, being a better spouse, a better parent, a better employee, someone who's more positive, an encouragement to others. If you enjoyed this discussion with Eric, please consider rating the show 5 stars and leaving a review. It really helps us reach more people and encourage them to come on the journey with us. Tune in next week as the trilogy concludes, when we'll talk to Eric about how we can determine the thing we should monetize.
Farewell, listeners. Tune in next time as the journey continues. I'm John White at VJourneyman, for Nick Cordy at Network Nerd _, signing off.
Adios.